Well, thank you for collectively inviting me to come to speak with you or to share the Dharma with you this weekend. I've enjoyed my day yesterday, and I'll probably enjoy my time with you too. Sometimes we come to a Dharma practice, or we come to a meditation, or we come to spiritual practice, or recognize a spiritual need in our life. And oftentimes in our search for what we don't yet really know we're looking for, but we're looking for something, we sometimes tend to be attracted to or kind of be dazzled by, or our attention gets caught by the most flamboyant or esoteric or kind of unique or exotic or something that's distinctly different than what we have been doing or what we have known. And sometimes our spiritual practice can head off in a direction of something that's quite foreign and different and kind of bewildering, and you got to learn a whole new language, and it can be a challenge. But if you stop for a minute and you just think about who in your life now would you consider is a good person? Someone who's just a good person, an average, ordinary. Well, maybe most people in your life aren't good, so I couldn't say average and ordinary. But think of who you think is a good person. Just think of someone. And it might be someone intimate, familiar to you. It might be a national or international figure. It might be a historical figure. But just think of someone. Who would you consider to be a good human being? Now, take a look at what is it about that person that encourages you to think of them in that way? What quality of heart or what quality of mind or what behavior do they display that makes you think that about them? Maybe they're kind or generous, or they're always present with you when you're there, or you know, they've accomplished something extraordinary in their life for the benefit of others, or maybe they're just patient and kind of present in a very simple but grounded way. Just see if you can identify what quality or qualities this person has or displays. My guess is that most of the qualities that get identified would be contained on this list that I've handed out of what are called the paramis. And if you look at this list of what are called the 10 paramis, and you see what these qualities of mind are, generosity, morality, or living in harmony with one another, renunciation or letting go, wisdom or understanding, energy, patience, truthfulness, being resolute or kind of steadfast, loving kindness, equanimity or balance. My guess is that the person you selected and the qualities that, or the behaviors that most predominate in their behavior and in their mind has something to do with, or is one of these, or very close to one of these. The paramis in the teachings of the Buddha are considered the forces of purity in our life, forces of purity in our mind, because when these qualities are recognized and awakened and developed through active practices, then we purify the mind of greed or attachment, hatred or any kind of aversion, and delusion or ignorance and confusion. And when the mind is, or as the mind gradually becomes purified of greed, hatred, and delusion, and there are many manifestations of them, we become more awake to life, all of life. And so these forces are practices in and of themselves. But you might notice that there's nothing particularly Buddhist about them. Generosity, you know, loving kindness, patience, truthfulness. What's so Buddhist about that? Really, these are the qualities of all good human beings. In whatever culture, whatever religion, whatever spiritual tradition, or wherever you might find someone with any or all or some degree of these qualities, they would be recognized as, and in their particular community, as a good human being. And all of us have all of these qualities to begin with. Is there anyone here who doesn't, well, I won't say all the time, but hasn't been patient before, or truthful, or loving, or generous? Of course. We all have these qualities within our mind, within our heart, and we all know what it feels like to practice generosity or to really sincerely wish someone well, to really love them, meaning to want the best for them. We know what that feels like. But we also recognize that these qualities of mind are not our default setting. It's not like they are the first thing that comes up, you know, as a response in every situation. And so we can recognize that while these qualities are notable and noteworthy and maybe the best of humanity, that there's some room for improvement. And oftentimes, just remembering what these qualities are and that, oh, this is a possible response in this situation, rather than some other habitual or conditioned reaction that is rooted in greed, hatred, or delusion. And so, as we go along in our spiritual practice, our search for whatever it is we think the spiritual life or meditation or awakening is all about, we will see that gradually these 10 qualities of mind are growing in us. They're growing both in our capacity to recognize them and appreciate them in ourselves and others. They're growing in the sense that they arise more frequently in our heart, in our mind. And they're growing in the strength of them in our life. You know, it's not just, you know, a little patience, you know, if you make a lot of effort. It's like you can really develop strong and compelling patience as the default setting of your mind. And when it has been trained, or when you train your heart to be patient with, well, all that's hard to be patient with, you know that it brings a great relief. It brings relief from suffering. It doesn't have to be a great thing, but just, you know, being patient when someone cuts you off, either at the traffic light or in a conversation. Or just being able to be generous to those who are in need. Or to have a balanced mind, to have an equanimous mind. As you know, we all face and come in contact with trials and tribulations every day. That's just the nature of a human life. And we can, you know, piss and moan and kind of complain and whinge and whine about this person or the way it is, and we'd like it to be different and yada, yada, yada. But you know what? Who's suffering? We're suffering. And this is just the way it is for all human beings. An enlightened person, or a person who's awake, or someone who has more fully developed the spiritual path, it's not that they somehow live in some rare air where they don't have to face difficulties anymore. Forget it. It's not that way at all. It's more that they have cultivated these qualities of mind so that they arise more quickly, more strongly, more frequently when faced with the inevitable challenges of a human existence. They're called paramis, and the word parami means perfection. Because in one sense, these are the qualities of heart and mind that the bodhisattva who became the Buddha, Gautama Buddha, 2,500 years ago, these are the qualities of heart and mind that the bodhisattva perfected as an ascetic, Sumedha, eons and eons and eons, life cycles, world cycles, long time ago, you know, before time, they say. When the ascetic Sumedha saw a former Buddha, Dipankara Buddha, and admired the qualities of the Buddha and aspired to become a Buddha, when his aspiration was recognized by Dipankara Buddha, it then set this mind stream of this ascetic on the path of developing these qualities of mind to perfection. Meaning, they became the default setting in every situation that this being faced throughout many, many lifetimes. Now imagine what it would take in your life for you to make any one of these the default setting if there was an opportunity. So that every time there was a choice of being impatient or patient, your mind would automatically be patient. Or any time there was an opportunity to be angry, irritated, frustrated, or loving, it would always be loving. Without a second's wavering in the mind. That's what it takes to become a Buddha. Well, fortunately for us, most of us haven't made that aspiration yet, and we don't have to quite wait till. But we have the opportunity every day to practice kindness, to practice generosity, to practice truthfulness. And it's in this recognition that every moment that we remember these and practice these, even for a moment, it is fulfilling in that moment the path of awakening. And as these forces accumulate power in our mind, we'll see how they work, and the cumulative reward, if you will, of these qualities of mind being aroused and present in our life is a sense of well-being. Not just pleasure, not just happiness, not just joy, but a sense of well-being. And a sense of well-being is sustained even in times of difficulty and challenge. Pleasure comes and goes. Happiness can come and go. But a sense of well-being, once established in the mind and strengthened, isn't shaken even when things get difficult. Because there's a level of confidence, and there's a level of trust, and there's a level of self-knowledge that these qualities of heart are available for dealing with whatever comes up. So these are the forces of mind that the bodhisattva perfected to become a Buddha. They are the forces of mind which we could call them in in this tradition, in this Theravada tradition of Buddhist practice, or the insight tradition, if you will, these are what are called or serve in the role of preparatory practices. They prepare you for liberating insight. And in fact, in Burma, the home of, or the seat of the tradition in which we practice. And I might just mention that I met Gil in 1985 when we were both monks ordained in Burma practicing at the Mahasi Meditation Center. And so I've known him for a long time. We've had a good connection, although we've been out of touch for a decade or more. And I was really happy when I heard that he was here and was running this type of, or was kind of leading this community. And we've since reconnected and had a good reminisce, if you will, about our Dhamma practice and time together in Burma. But the understanding in Burma and other Theravadan countries is that in our life as householders, and in our family life, and our careers, and our schooling, and our community, and our civic responsibilities, it is the cultivation of these qualities that prepare the heart for insight, for the liberating insight of Vipassana. And the understanding is that to the degree that these qualities of mind are strengthened and available, then the degree of freedom or the degree of liberation in the mind is that much greater. So, we don't have to wait for a retreat or a day of practice or when we can finally go do a 3-month retreat, or if you ever aspire to ordain for a period of time or go to Asia or whatever. You don't have to wait for that to do your practice. In any moment that you recognize the opportunity to practice any of these qualities of mind, you're doing all you can do in that time, in that moment, to prepare the heart for liberation, for letting go of that which causes suffering. I want to mention just a few more pieces of information about the paramis, and then I would like to take either questions or requests from you to elaborate on any one or more of these. These qualities of mind lie as a potential in the mind of all humans. But it takes some appreciation of them, some recognition of them, some acknowledgement of them in order to train the mind to cultivate the mind, to cultivate them in the mind so that they're more accessible and available to us when needed. To the degree that we understand that these are forces of purity and that these are the qualities of a good human being, to the degree that we understand that, we can more authentically or sincerely appreciate them in others and cultivate them in ourselves. And so as we choose to practice the paramis, it is the degree of understanding that we have that supports the degree of development of these. Any one of them, anybody can practice generosity. You see a beggar on the street, you just give him something, walk on. That's generosity. But if you bring understanding and some wise reflection to what it is you're doing, you know, what is the need, what it is you're doing, how you feel, how the other person feels, why you're doing it, and you reflect on that, you can grow in understanding of how to practice generosity more wisely. Each of these practices are a practice of happiness, so that if practiced wisely, correctly, their goal or the result is happiness. If you're practicing generosity and it's kind of making you resentful, you know, the practice of generosity is good, but the practice of resentment is kind of undermining the benefits you got. So we need to give some pause and some reflection as to, well, how do I practice generosity every time I have the opportunity in a way that makes or supports being happy? Well, you can see that's a challenge, isn't it? You know, or take any of the others. Renunciation. You know, renunciation is all about letting go. It's not about just being a monk or a nun, living in a cave, isolated, away from everybody. It's about letting go in any moment of something, someone, your opinion. And it's not easy. You know, often you'll see, if you look, if you really pay attention to your life, you'll look and see that you'd often rather be right than free. And that causes a lot of suffering. And that's how hard it is to let go of our opinions, our views and opinions. You know, this is what I prefer, and, you know, and we dig in our heels, and even though we're suffering, and the other person's suffering, and we're going tooth and nail, head to head, we can't let go. So, how can we practice renunciation and learn to let go so that it is a source of happiness in our life? That takes wisdom. That takes understanding. And that understanding and that wisdom only comes from careful reflection and paying attention to how you get hooked, how you get caught, how you generate any of these forces in your mind, how you act them out, what you learn from them. Sometimes we practice generosity and, you know, after we practice generosity, we walk away and an hour later, a day later, we start feeling like, God, I wasn't really very generous. I was kind of like, you know, kind of dismissive or kind of, or maybe we feel like, God, I gave too much. I gave to the wrong person. They're just going to go buy a bottle of wine. I know they're a wine. Yeah, you know. And we start feeling, you know, kind of bad about the way we practice generosity. Well, we don't need to feel bad about it. We will feel bad about it, or we may feel bad about it. But if you do, that's an opportunity to learn something. What happened there? Why is it not a source of happiness? And so we start to bring some really careful consideration into how we practice any of these. And in time, we learn to practice them, we could say, perfectly. When we can practice them perfectly, they are becoming a perfection in the mind. And to practice them perfectly means that they bring happiness. Not only are they a default setting, but they bring happiness. Okay, so there's the understanding of them. There's the recognition of them. There's the understanding of them. And there's practicing them with awareness. We could practice, you know, loving kindness. We can practice patience or truthfulness and have very little awareness of it. We just kind of, you know, we just kind of do it and there's not much awareness of it. To the degree that we bring a steady attention, a conscious attention, an intentional attention to our practice of these, then we see more about them. We see how they work in our mind, in our life, and how we can kind of make the subtlety of adjustments that can be made to enhance these qualities and to recognize the benefit that we feel or that we receive from them. So there's awareness, there's understanding, there's the quality themselves. There's one last element of practicing these qualities as paramis, which I want to mention. And that is, to just practice generosity is to just practice generosity. That is not a practice of a parami. To make it a practice of a parami, these practices have to be done with the aspiration that may this act of generosity, for example, be for the benefit and liberation of all beings. May this act of loving kindness be for the benefit and liberation of myself and all beings. Or may this act of renunciation, you know, you're looking through the catalogs, you know, I like that, I want that, I want that. And you finally decide, no, I'll just let it go. But add, and may this letting go of not buying that be for the liberation and benefit of all beings. Because, hey, you're letting go. And that's what renunciation is about. And so if you can remember that this is the direction of practice in order to make these the practice of paramis, then you'll see that not only are you kind of undertaking these practices in order to become a better human being for yourself and kind of get kind of fully yourself with that, but it's actually a great gift to practice these paramis for the benefit and welfare and liberation of other beings. And that's a gift that any one of us can give daily to everyone else in this room and beyond the reach of our sense doors. There. Finish. Now, I've been told that at 10:45, some of you are going to get up and walk out. So, and that's okay. Hey, I don't take it personally. But we have 10 minutes. So if there's any questions or if there's some confusion or some unclarity about any of these paramis and you'd like a little further elaboration, let me know and I can maybe do two. Are there any suggestions or questions? Yeah.
Are these guidelines or paramis considered to be absolutes? That is, I'm sure that in a sense they take one of them, truthfulness. There may be times when untruthfulness produces a greater good than truthfulness. And so therefore we would be inclined to lie rather than tell the truth and cause untoward consequences as just one example.
This is a really good question. You know, are these absolutes or not? And especially around the idea or the practice of truthfulness. And I'm sure all of us have had occasion to shade the truth. A little white lie, being less than full disclosure, thinking that I'll just save this other person from having to deal with the difficult consequences of whatever it is I would have to tell them if I told the truth. We might think that that is the best response, but I encourage you to really look at, you know, what's your motivation, what's the feeling in your heart when you do that, what is the reaction in the other person, and just to really pay attention with awareness to what is going on in yourself, in the other, in the situation. And not just in that moment, but, you know, prior to that moment when whatever it is you got to talk about happened, or after that moment when the consequences of your action and or the truthfulness and untruthfulness of what you said kind of play out. Sometimes in the moment, it might seem like, oh, I better not tell the truth. This is too much. This is too heavy. This is too shameful. This is too embarrassing. This is too hurtful. Something, whatever. And we don't. That has its consequences. And if we pay attention to that, we'll begin to notice what they are. I mentioned the ascetic Sumedha, who eons ago made the aspiration to become a Buddha and then lived hundreds of lifetimes in order to perfect these qualities. It is said that from the time that he made that aspiration, throughout all those lifetimes of trial and tribulation and every imaginable situation that you would have to be in to strengthen these qualities of mind, it is said that he broke every precept and didn't realize these paramis or didn't cultivate these paramis except truthfulness. From that moment on, he never wasn't truthful. Lifetimes of truthfulness. Now think about it. Awakening is about coming to know the Dharma. The Dharma is the way things are. We could say the Dharma is the truth. The Dharma is the way things are. And our spiritual practice is to come to know the truth, the way things are. A commitment to the truth. Let me just say, a commitment to convenience might not be good enough. But it's something for us to discover in our own lives. I mean, it's hard. It is hard to be truthful. Let's face it. You know, every one of us is carrying around little secrets that, you know, and we don't have to, you know, expose ourselves either. But we do have to start to or continue to pay close, really close and closer attention to the effect of untruthfulness in our mind and how that makes us feel. How's that for an ambiguous answer?
The classic truthfulness dilemma that I've heard many times is the Nazis come to the door and ask the Dutch couple, "Are you hiding any Jews?" What do you say?
I'm not in that situation, and I couldn't honestly say. You know, because I think that what's important is that we recognize the situations we're in and cultivate in that moment what we can. In that situation, I wouldn't know. A hypothetical situation, there's just no way to know. You cannot know.
But you'd probably agree, it's not the truthfulness is not necessarily an absolute.
Oh, is that the question? You know, even the Buddha allowed people, laymen and women who were escaping war to put on robes as if they were a monk or nun in order to escape the danger of war. Let that be instructive.
Right. Thank you.
Here's another, yeah.
Equanimity is difficult to understand in this context, and I know it's pretty very broad and deep topic, but could you give a little explanation more of equanimity?
Do you mean particularly about this particular quote, or just equanimity in a general sense?
In a general sense.
Equanimity. Equanimity is, of course, balance of mind. And often we talk about balance of mind in terms of what are called the eight vicissitudes of life, or the eight lokadharmas, the conditions of life that we all face. Pleasure and pain. And by the way, is there anyone who has not experienced pleasure and pain? No, of course. How about fame and disrepute? Anybody who hasn't experienced some level of fame, I mean, in your family, you know, you won the 100-yard dash or, you know, some level of fame and disrepute, you know, having done something really you'd rather not talk about or remember. Praise and blame, fame and disrepute, gain and loss. We've all experienced gain of material goods or good health, and we've also experienced loss. Pleasure, pain, pleasure. What's the other two? Anyway, there's another pair. And we all experience them. And yet, all of us have the conditioned habit to want the praise, the pleasure, the fame, and we don't want the pain, the disrepute, and etc. Is that even reasonable? Think about it. That is ridiculous. You know, and yet, we will get all stirred up and our mind will get very reactive and we'll suffer if we're not able to accept the inevitable pain that comes in life, the inevitable loss that comes in life, the inevitable shame or disrepute that comes in life, and other unpleasant conditions. They are bound to come. There isn't any one of us, there's no human being on the face of the earth that can escape unpleasantness in their life. Why get upset about it? Really, think about that. It's inevitable. Why get upset? We would be better off to develop the strength of mind to accept this is the way it is for now and know that all things change. Just to have that understanding, to try to accept this is the way it is right now and everything changes eventually. Those two understandings could allow us to withstand any of the storms of life with a balanced, non-reactive mind. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't try to do the best you can to alleviate your own and others' suffering and pain and shame and loss and all that. Of course, you do what you can. But when the inevitable comes, to have the strength of mind to see, this is the way it is. This is the way it is. You know, you don't have to blame yourself or others. You don't have to kind of fall into the, you know, the morass of self-pity. Oh, poor me, I can't do because blah, 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 you know. And every one of us in this room has faced the same and will again in the future face difficult situations. You know, we don't plan for that. We plan to have, you know, a happy future. All of us in the making of our plans for the future never make plans for suffering. Hello, we should. We should be making contingency plans for the inevitable suffering that's coming. You know, and that is, the contingency plan is strengthen the mind in equanimity. Cultivate equanimity. Develop equanimity. You know, see how to, you know, bring some wisdom to these situations. Even reflecting on the fact that, you know what, you're going to get sick. You know, are you making plans for that yet? You know, and I don't mean just buy health insurance. I mean, you're going to get sick, the body's going to get old, and you're going to die. There, deal with it. I was like, oh my God, this guy's, you know, kind of raw. Yeah, well, hello. You know, this is the truth. This is the way things are for us as human beings. Now, making plans to deal with the inevitable and the not only inevitable, the for sure, you can count on it. You know, that's what our spiritual practice is. Developing the strength of mind, the strength of qualities of mind to enable us to accept in the moment as it all occurs, as it all happens, with awareness and understanding. This is the way it is. It can be dealt with. It's 10:45, and any of you can leave if you want. I'm going to take one last guy. Yeah, please.
Like the levels of truthfulness might come from neutrality, acceptance, serenity, understanding, compassion, and then ultimately love.
Yes.
And the intent is where the greatest truthfulness comes from.
The is intent.
The intent.
Yeah. I think that attention to intention is essential for practicing any spiritual discipline. Because it's actually the intention, why we're doing something, what's the motivation in doing what we do, that is going to deeply condition the result. And the result is always in the realm, and I mean the result, not external to yourself, but the result in your heart is going to be deeply conditioned by the intention, the motivation with which you undertake whatever it is you do. This is the law of karma. I'm sure you've heard about the law of karma. If you've been practicing at all, you've heard about karma. And that's what intention is. Intention is karma. You know, and as you plant the seeds of awareness and understanding and love and compassion, you will reap the fruit of pleasantness and happiness. As you plant the seeds of self-interest and greed and hatred and delusion of some form or another, you will reap the fruit of unpleasantness and unhappiness. You know, this is the way it is. If you look carefully, if you pay attention with some continuity to your life, the life of the mind, the life of the heart, you will see in general that this is true. There are some other claims about the law of karma and the law of karma as it's acted out that may be too subtle to perceive in your own life, but you'll be able to see the broad strokes of, you know, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. So, thank you for coming to share this time and space with us. If I have in any way said anything that has confused you or offended you or hurt you or shamed you in some way, I didn't intend to. Sometimes just out of, you know, wrong language in this community or something, some people can feel hurt some way. It wasn't my intention. But I hope that you're able to accept this gift of the Dharma and find it useful and beneficial in your life. And since the Dharma path is a long, wide path, see you later.